Ayn Rand's novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, have sold over 12 million copies in the United States alone, and sales have reportedly spiked recently, spurred by conservatives who are throwing tea parties and opposing Obama administration health care and economic proposals. But I'm sure most of those readers know very little about the author's life. Now, Anne C. Heller offers a complete portrait from Rand's childhood in Russia to the cult of personality that developed around her in the 1950s and 60s in Ayn Rand and the World That She Made. I added that there, right? And the World She Made, which is published by Nanae Talese, an imprint of Doubleday. And I'm very pleased that it brings Anne Heller to our show today. Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
Ayn Rand was born Alyssa Zinovyeva Rosenbaum in pre-revolutionary Russia in 1905. What was her childhood in St. Petersburg like?
Until the age of 12, she grew up in an upwardly mobile, bourgeois Jewish household, very conventional, kind of late Victorian household.
Were they affected at all by the persecution against the Jews?
I don't know whether they particularly were, but the family came from the Russian Pale of Settlement, and it was hard to get into St. Petersburg if you were a Jew. And I assume that if they weren't directly affected, their relatives had been.
You write about her difficult relationship with her mother. What kind of expectations did her mother have of her?
Her mother, until the revolution, wanted her to be popular and active and have a ladylike profession and wear pretty clothes. And Ayn Rand was not built for those tasks. She was solitary, brooding, intelligent, serious, even grim. She had trouble making friends. She was aware that people thought she was too serious and didn't like her. She thought that was a social fault in her until she decided that it was envy in others.
And she was superior. World War One broke out at this time, and then the Russian Revolution, 1917. She was just 12 years old.
She was just 12 years old.
And did they shape her worldview?
She was a very smart 12-year-old and very impressionable, and it absolutely shaped her worldview. Shortly after the Bolsheviks took over St. Petersburg, they sent soldiers to close down shops and factories owned by the bourgeoisie, and Rand happened to be in her father's pharmacy on the day the soldiers came to take the goods and loot them and lock the door, and that was the end of his livelihood. He never worked again because he wouldn't work for the communists, and that was the only work there was.
And they left St. Petersburg. Where did they go?
They went to the Crimea, to the Black Sea, because that was the last place where the Red soldiers hadn't gotten to, and they stayed there for 3 years and came back once it was conquered.
Well, then she did benefit from the Bolsheviks in her college education, which was free and open to Jews and to women.
She did.
What did she study?
She studied history and philosophy. She did benefit. The school year, the school term was moved from 5 to 3 years. Unfortunately, Rand was quite mouthy and quite, she liked to speak out against communism. And in her third year, students like herself were being evicted. And some of them who were the children of the bourgeoisie were being exported and sent into bad places. Rand was expelled and then allowed to come back.
Well, this is during the better years before Stalin came to power.
Yes, indeed.
She fell in love with a man named Lev Beckerman, and she started reading Nietzsche.
Yes, she did. Nietzsche was very popular in intellectual circles in Russia in those days.
Well, do you think that Nietzsche, whose ideas were quite complex, would have been pleased by her version of his thinking?
Well, I must say I don't have a nodding acquaintance with Nietzsche, but having read some of his work, I think he was a little more complex a thinker than Rand was.
But she says that she modeled herself, her ideas, on his.
She said that he got to her ideas first.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't model herself on anyone.
So
she was an original.
That makes them equal, actually.
Absolutely.
When and how did she leave Russia?
She was very lucky to have relatives in Chicago. very lucky to be able to obtain a passport and a temporary visa, 6-month visa to the United States to study film so that she could come back, as she told the authorities, to make propaganda movies for Lenin. And she never came back, needless to say. Her parents and sisters remained there, and after World War II started, she didn't hear from them again, ever.
So did she ever find out what happened to them?
She did. After the war, she found out that her mother and father had died of illness during the siege of Leningrad, that her sister had been died in an air raid, and that cousins had died, and her youngest sister survived, but she didn't know that for a long time.
Now, the move to the United States allowed her to remake herself, didn't it? To the point where she changed her name. How did she come up with the name Ayn Rand?
It's a mystery to Ayn Rand admirers. I don't know about Rand, but except that it is gender neutral, unethnic, quite bland. Ayn, my theory is that Ayn is from a nickname that her father had for her when she was little, Ayanuchka, which means bright eyes. And others think that it came from a Finnish writer or that she made it up herself. She told different stories about it at different times.
When did she start writing?
She started writing at 11 when she decided that was going to be her vocation. She started writing her first novel, which got published. She wrote a play and a screenplay in the late 20s while she was learning English. The play was actually produced. The screenplay was purchased. But her first mature work was a novel called We the Living, which is quite a nice novel. It's an autobiographical work about 1923 and 1924 in St. Petersburg as Lenin is solidifying his power.
And we start seeing some of the ideas that we recognize later, the anti-collectivist viewpoint,
yes,
for example, in that book.
It's openly Nietzschean in that its theme is that collectivism and state domination are hardest on the best people, the most gifted people, the people who deserve to live more than ordinary people do, more than the people who benefit from state interference do.
Well, there's something also slightly anti-democratic about her worldview. And here she is in Hollywood, which has always been seen as a hotbed of leftist thinking, at least among the intellectuals, the people she would have been consorting with. How did they react to her?
Well, she moved to New York in 1934, so she missed the growth of communism, the beginning of it in Hollywood.
But she had written four Hollywood films, hadn't she?
She'd been working for Cecil B. DeMille, but she lost that job and went to work in a wardrobe department and was a clerk and so on. She came to New York in 1934 with her play, and it was then that she began to be aware of intellectuals and their tendencies to be left-wing and communist, and she was very alarmed and very angry. She thought they were ruining the best country on earth, and she was determined to do something about it.
My guest is Ann C. Heller, who has been the managing editor of the Antioch Review, a fiction editor at Esquire and Red Book, and features editor at Lear's. So she's known some strong women over the years, especially Frances Lear. Her book, Ayn Rand and the World She Made, is published by Doubleday in the Nan Talese imprint. We come to The Fountainhead, her second novel. This is the book that really changes everything. It's the first full portrait of an individualist hero. I don't know if there's any book like it before, is there? Is there ever a character like Howard Roark? Or is he even a character?
Yeah, that's a question many people ask. He's somewhat one-dimensional and wooden. He has no inner conflicts, which we're used to in our characters. There have been very few heroes who are, you know, productive heroes, capitalist heroes, if you were. He wasn't explicitly a capitalist hero, but he was a builder and a creator of new things that would create wealth for others. She had a favorite book called Calumet K, which was published at the turn of the century. It was an anti-union novel with a hero who stops the unions and gets the grain on the train in time. It's kind of it's a very interesting relic of another time. And that could be seen as a predecessor to Howard Roark.
Is Howard Roark her vision of an ideal man?
He was at the time she wrote it. She went on to create other ideal men who were even more ideal than Howard Roark was.
Well, she starts off the book and ends the book with the words Howard Roark.
Mm-hmm.
And you make a point of pointing that out. Why?
Because Howard Roark is both the medium and the message of the Fountainhead.
Is it true that he was modeled partly on Frank Lloyd Wright?
Oh, very much so. She denied it. But if you go back and you read Frank Lloyd Wright's autobiography, which was published in 1932, I think, a really wonderful American artifact, she took whole scenes and from that book.
But she denied it.
And she denied it.
She did say, my research material for the psychology of Roark was myself.
Yes.
Well, every writer will say that, won't they?
Well, I suppose so. She said that about everything. She said later on in life when she had put together what she considered to be a complete philosophy, she said that her only predecessor was Aristotle.
Well, what did she say in the Individualist Manifesto that she wrote in 1948?
That's where she laid out the groundwork for her philosophy, and particularly for limited government and free markets. She felt that the government, the state, especially in America where we have a constitution, should be limited to a few basic functions, and each of those should be with the purpose of preserving individual liberty to, you know, make money, be happy, produce whatever you want, trade with your equals, and so on.
Well, this is after the New Deal, after FDR, but it's at the beginning of the Cold War. Is this a reflection of it?
No, not at this time. It's a reflection of her anger that the left had such an organized ideology and organized spokespeople, and that the right didn't.
She came up with a philosophical approach called objectivism. And I remember when I was at Brooklyn College, one of the philosophy teachers complained that the department had been taken over by the objectivists. She explained objectivism, or to some degree, to Mike Wallace on a TV show in 1959, and we'd like to play a little clip from that.
Good.
My morality is based on man's life as a standard of value. And since man's mind is his basic means of survival, I hold that if man wants to live on Earth and to live as a human being, he has to hold reason as an absolute, by which I mean that he has to hold reason as his only guide to action, and that he must live by the independent judgment of his own mind, that his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness, and that he must not force other people, nor accept their right to force him, that each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
Which some people have interpreted as a rationale for selfishness.
Well, she wasn't against selfishness. Her second nonfiction book was called The Virtue of Selfishness. But what she's not promoting is greed. The honor and honesty of people who deal with each other is a basic tenet of her thinking.
And you point out that when she was offered a choice of editing her book and making more money and not editing it and losing some money, she chose the latter because she believed in the importance of her ideas.
Yes, her ideas were the most important thing to her.
But what is objectivism and all of this meant to conservatives today? Some conservatives, they read it as an economic philosophy. Did she intend it as such?
She once said that capitalism was her political philosophy, and free markets were her watchword. However, what was I going to say? I'm sorry.
I don't know. I was asking about whether the people who are citing her again today are reading economic philosophy into her work.
No, she laid out her feelings about free markets and lack of government regulation and small government very clearly. But they do forget some things about her. They forget she was an atheist and that she was against any talk of God in the political sphere.
Now, Atlas Shrugged was the next book, which is a defense of capitalism. Immediate bestsellers, both of these books, Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged?
No. The Fountainhead took about 3 or 4 years to become a bestseller. It was a word-of-mouth book. There wasn't much advertising, and people just told each other about it. And then there was a film of The Fountainhead, and
Gary Cooper.
Yes, it was never out of print again.
Well, did anybody defend this as great literature? When I dipped into these books when I was young, the writing struck me as rather clunky.
The writing is clunky. The characters are wooden, and there are other literary faults with it. But these are novels of ideas in which she rather beautifully integrates the ideas into a suspenseful plot, and all of these melodramatic characters, not so unlike some 19th century novelists who have stage characters who enact their ideas for them.
Was it the novels that attracted all of those other people to her, people like Alan Greenspan?
Alan Greenspan in particular, the answer is yes. But later on, she was writing nonfiction in the 1960s. She was systematizing her ideas into the objectivist philosophy. And what people liked about her then was that she had an answer for every question. She had a universe that there was no doubt and no injustice and no problem, because Ayn Rand had an answer for that.
Which led to something of cultish behavior and an acolyte who actually renamed himself Brandon to stick the word Rand in the middle of his last name. We can't get to all of that, but the book is fascinating, and thinking about Ayn Rand remains fascinating. Ann C. Heller's Ayn Rand and the World She Made is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.